So, Kirk, I spent a little more time trying to translate the sixth proverb. And I have come to the conclusion, at least of the proverbs that I have translated, and I have probably only translated a dozen of them so far, that most all, at least of those the proverbs that I've translated, they are written such that the father is Yahweh, the mother is our spiritual mother, the Ruach Kodesh, and the son is, in most cases, just any child of the covenant, but in some cases, the first child of the covenant, which would be the diminished manifestation of Yahweh Yahusha. And so these are family instructions. So these are really useful because they're instructions on how to be part of the family. It's like kind of dad saying, here are the things you want to watch out for and be careful of. Here are the things that will be helpful along the way.
Right.
I find this proverb to be the same.
Right.
I don't think there's many people that would agree with me.
Well,
a vast majority of people view it quite differently, that these are just helpful advice written by just some scribe out there that had nothing to do with God. Just, you know, a guy out there saying, here's some, you know, Richard's almanac on how to be a good dad or a good son.
Well, that's no. Go back to verse 11, and it starts with, he describes the Torah, this one.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not just simple instruction on how to read Torah. I mean, this is pretty heavy stuff. This is, he starts, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he starts out talking about future, because he is talking about the Torah as one. If he's not, I'm confused with my understanding. And then he says, presently, which brings us back to the now, wherever the now was at the time. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. My understanding is, and I want to use understanding loosely here because I haven't finished the translation, and I never want to infer that my take on something is the valid one and others are not valid.
No.
But my current take on it is that the answer is that this may well have been written by Dode at the time of King Saul, and is written as an indictment against all that he stood for. I think it is also an ode to the largest religious group ever conceived,
right.
Christianity, and therefore an express warning against the wannabe apostle Shaul, known to Christians as Paul, the author of half of their New Testament.
Right.
Likewise, I'm fairly convinced that this is a prophetic warning about the pledge, the mark of the beast, if you will, pledge to one's country and economic system that becomes your undoing, and that speaks specifically of the Torahless one, known to Christians as the Antichrist. So I'm, at least my take is at this point that it's all three of them and that they all three bear all of these characteristics in common.
Right. One is the architect of the other and the other. I mean,
yeah.
They always work
right.
That way. You know, always tell
right.
It that way. So that's to defend to me, I would think. I mean, it'd be wrong, but.
The closest prototype we have to Paul is King Saul.
King Saul.
The closest prototype we have to the Torahless one is the wannabe Apostle Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it as possibly all three, and I think God is telling us that. But this is how it begins, and I've only done the first verse, the first and second verses here, and then we're going to skip way down to more like 12, and then consider 12 through 15 as they lead to the six things that God hates and the seven that are abominations.
Okay.
It begins, my son, my child, if you have him as a concession, and is often as. You have given a pledge and have joined in to be accepted. A rob. You made a bargain or a promise in association with others as a participant in a societal, a religious, or economic institution. Or if you've taken an oath to come to the aid of those thereby associated with one another, either providing a security or making a personal agreement or guarantee to engage in their business, their commerce, mingling in to please others, only to be welcomed, found acceptable, and to be included. So let me go back to the beginning. My son, if you have given a pledge and have joined in to be accepted by your country, your raya, your fellow countrymen, your social, geographic, racial, or religious group, even your neighbors and fellow citizens, then you have bound yourself to a stranger, to someone who is estranged from my hand. The words of your mouth are your snare, and you're caught by them, by the very words of your own mouth.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for starters?
That's just a rack your teeth.
Whoa.
On your heel.
Now, it's not translated that way in English bibles. No, they say that it's if you make a pledge to a neighbor. But Rhea, while it can be translated neighbor, is the primary meaning would be fellow countrymen. This is a pledge to your country, but pledge is only a small part of what Arab means. I mean, there's the word Arab, if you look it up in your lexicons, you'll find that its meanings are so broad and yet interconnected, that they'll present the exact same word, written exactly the same way, four different times, rather than having it, you know, like they normally do. Here's the primary meaning, secondary meaning, third, you know, tertiary meaning, and the fourth meaning of the word. They actually present Arab four different ways, four different times. But if you look at each of them, what you come to is, this is the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah.
This is, if you've made a pledge, and clearly Rhea is to your fellow citizens, to your countrymen, to your country, to your race, your religious group, even your neighbors and fellow citizens. If you've made a pledge to join in and be accepted, I pledge allegiance.
Yeah.
If you've made a bargain or a promise in associating with the others, as a participant in any societal, religious, economic institution, or taken an oath to come to the aid of those thereby associated with one another, making a personal agreement or guarantee to engage in whatever it is that they're doing, their business, their commerce. In fact, engaging, if you make a guarantee to buy and sell. Now, this now talks about the last days and the mark of the beast. Mingling in to please others, to be welcomed, to be found acceptable, to be included with your country, then you've bound yourself to a stranger.
Yeah.
To one is estranged from my hand, and the words of your mouth are your snare, and you're caught by them, the very words of your own mouth. Boy, in the context of walk away from Babel, walk away from confusion, walk away from Babylon, disassociate yourself from the whore of Babylon. The whore is going to come up later in this
sure.
proverb.
Mm-hmm.
In the prophecy about the mark of the beast, and you'll have to take the mark of the beast to be able to buy and sell.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's talking about right here.
Right.
He's right. talking about patriotism and citizenry, and rather than walking away from one's country, showing allegiance to it.
Well, it's definitely a pledge. I mean, if anybody's not looking it up, I just did. It's a pledge.
Yeah, it's a pledge. But look at all of the variations of Arab, the additional meanings. And it's a talks about this going along to get along, that you're making promises. You're offering an oath for the purpose of fitting in, of being welcomed, for being accepted.
Yeah,
Boy, isn't that why people do it? I mean, what happens if you don't stand and take off your hat and put your hand on your heart as they're playing the national anthem at a sporting event?
You're probably getting a fight or at least get run off.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're going to be at the very least verbally accosted.
Yeah, and the Aussies have to stand up and sing God Save the Queen. It's no different.
Yeah, either. Right. What would happen when the American flag walks by at a parade?
If you're supposed to take off your hat or put your hand on your, all that stuff.
What if you run for public office and they ask you to put your hand on your bibble and your babble and swear an oath?
Yeah, same thing in a courtroom. And
yeah, when you want to become a citizen of the United States and you come from another country, aren't you required to swear an oath of allegiance?
Oh yeah. They watched it on TV last night.
Yep. When you go through the Roman Catholic Catechism, don't you have to swear an oath of allegiance at the end to be accepted?
I would assume so. I'd have to ask my wife. She grew up Catholic, so she knew. But I would assume so.
Yeah.
Or somebody has to.
Mm-hmm.
Bless you.
And in Islam, for you to be considered a Muslim, you got to swear the oath of allegiance where you acknowledge that Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet.
Every institution of man forces you to pledge to them.
Oh, of course. The U.S. Army, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Marines, the U.S. Navy, all require you to swear an oath of allegiance to them. Absolutely. So he says here, if you swear an allegiance, make an oath to be accepted by a group, whether that group is a racial group, a societal group, a geographic group, or a religious group. You've been ensnared with your own words. You've made a deal with a stranger, with someone who is estranged from God. And your own words will do you in. Now, is that fair? Or has God given us any indication that we ought not do that so that we can say, wait a minute, we weren't warned. Why would you tell us that we shouldn't do this?
No, he told you from the start not to do this. He said, walk away.
Right. Wasn't the first that you've got the stories of walking away. You've got in the garden they walked away from God and walked over there to Hasatan and he confused them in misquoting Yahweh, quoting him out of context. And they were walked right out of fellowship, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Noah choosing to walk away from the society that he was among. Not to swear an oath to them, but instead to throw in his fate with Yahweh. Followed Yahweh's instructions, not society's instructions. And how that worked out for Noah versus those who hung with their societal institutions. And then you've got Abraham, walk out of Babel.
Yeah. And then Moshe goes and gets them and says, let's walk out of here.
Yeah, Moshe goes to Egypt where, God's constantly saying, I'm the one that liberated you from the crucible of Mitzrayim, from human oppression, religious, political, military, and economic oppression. And he says, let's walk out of here.
This ain't right.
Yeah, so, right, so.
Over and over and over and over.
Over and over again, he's told it, this is what you ought to do. What did he do with Lot? Let's walk out of here.
Well, turn away, go.
And don't turn back. Don't turn back, man. Turning back is going to be a bad thing. Just walk out of here. And so he's constantly told us that's what we ought to do. And here he's affirming it, that if you don't heed that advice, but you instead make a pledge of allegiance to your religion, to whatever institution. Or you accept a branding for the expression of being able to buy and sell, for the purpose of being able to buy and sell. Then your words are going to be your own trap. You're going to be ensnared by them.
Well, let me add one. This is appropriate. One of the meanings for the same word for pledge is a crime, what causes one to become bound by ropes.
Yeah, and what the basis of the English word religion is? It's based on the Latin, which means to rebind, and it's a ligament in Latin. And so as to, the ligaments hold things together, bind things together. So to be bound again and again is the basis of the English word religion.
Yeah, you can't. So it's not a, there's no way that can be a mistranslation.
Yeah, so yeah, what he's saying here is that you can choose, and if you do, if you choose to be bound to a human institution, then you're estranged from me. And that your pledge to be bound to this human institution will be the very trap that ensnares you. That's the start. Now, I want to jump ahead, and that's 6, 1, and 2. Let's jump ahead to Proverbs 6:12. It begins with this. A wicked and worthless, Ba'al, a vile and evil, a troublesome and abhorred, valueless, ungodly, destructive and corrupt person. An unjust, false, evil, and vain, Aon, egotistical, invalid, and unreliable man. Goes about with perverse and corrupt speech.
Yeah.
All singular here. This man, this individual. It is very possible that the wicked and worthless person, the unjust, evil, and vain individual, is King Saul. More likely, because it's a better fit, the wannabe apostle Paul. But it's also indicative of the Torahless one, the Antichrist.
Yeah, it's I'm just reading all the different translations, and quite frankly, most of the Bibles have it right, even.
Yeah.
It translates this way. So.
Yep. And that that those who are evil, those who are egotistical and invalid, pervert and corrupt with their words. With their mouth,
yeah.
With speech. And here the tactic that is used is perversion and corruption. What tactic did Hasatan use in the garden?
I'm talking about words. All he said is, did he really say that?
Yeah. He perverted and corrupted Yahweh's testimony. That was the tactic. What did Paul use to create Christianity?
The same thing.
Perverted and corrupted God's testimony. He did not create Christianity out of a whole cloth, out of something that he knitted himself. It wasn't something that he conceived, but instead he perverted and corrupted that which God had said. That's what Satan didn't come to Adam and Chawa and said, hey, do I have a deal for you? Let's listen to my proposal. No, he didn't create a new opportunity for them. He simply perverted and twisted, corrupted the existing opportunity.
Well, doesn't that prove your point that words are more powerful than bullets and bombs?
Of course. Always have been. According to Yahweh, they are.
Well, I mean, even to humans, I mean, we should recognize that, you know, you write a book like Mon Calf or Muhammad's
mm-hmm.
book, or
mm-hmm.
stuff they finally wrote down a couple of years later.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, Mon Calf, the Quran.
The New Testament. I mean, look at the powerful
The New Testament,
word.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, look at the influence of the disastrous influence of those words.
Yeah, actually,
of all of them.
Later.
Yeah, the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud.
Absolutely.
So yeah, words, particularly the written word, because it has an enduring capacity to it, is the most deadly thing in the world. But the written word almost never occurs without first having been spoken. Paul gave his speeches, he wrote it down. Rabbi Akiva gave his proclamations, he wrote it down. Muhammad gave his recitals, someone wrote it down. And so this is from the mouth, because that's where it begins. And then it goes on to, it's engraved. So from mouth to then to writing.
Good point.
But it is through perversion and corruption. That's the reason that Christianity fools so many people. It's the reason Islam fools so many people, that they did not create their mythology out of a new invention, but instead corrupted and perverted the truth to give their lies credibility, to make them seem believable. Then it says of this wicked and worthless individual, they have a sinister winking of his eyes, a subtle shuffling, signaling with his feet, all while casting aspersions with his fingers. Sure sounds like the people that we have been able to witness in our lifetime. You know, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, this current pope. There's a sinister twinkling in their eyes, a kind of a winking, and the way that they handle their face. And this word for the sinister winking is from karats. It means to accuse maliciously, to chew up, to slander, and to denounce. These are eyes that are very telling. And eyes, ain also means perspective and understanding. And then a subtle signaling by shuffling, malal, is equally valid being translated to communicate, to utter, as it is to be a verbal sign where you've got the waddling and shifting of the feet. You know, if you're a shifty individual, this is the indication of a shifty individual. Shuffling their feet. You know, can't stand still. You're not firmly planted. You're shifty. While casting aspersions with his fingers. And yara is the word for casting aspersions. It's while hurling destructive accusations, which overturn valid teaching. You know, here, this verb is yara. Yara is, you know, I didn't expect to see yara here because I've always just gone immediately to the third definition of yara. Because Yahweh uses the third definition of yara to define Torah. Yara, the verb, is the basis of Torah. It means to teach, to guide, to instruct. But you do know that was the third? I didn't really know that until yesterday. But that's the third definition of yara. The primary definition of yara is to cast aspersions, to hurl destructive accusations, to overturn valid teaching. So yara has to be defined by its context. Goes on to say, with confusing and false perceptions, which invert reality in his heart as part of his ambitions and motivations. He designs and inscribes, this would be rites, antagonistic schemes without consideration of their consequence, which are evil in everything, continuously creating controversies and strife as one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something that's important. Now, Kirk, I don't think you're going to find that translation in your handy Babel.
No.
But in this particular case, we have to eliminate King Saul, because King Saul didn't go out of his way to write schemes like this.
No, he was.
So we move beyond him, and I don't even know in this particular case if we can include the Torahless one, known as the Antichrist, in this, because I don't know what he's going to do in terms of inscribing antagonistic schemes, writing them down. But we know a guy that started with his words and then went to his letters.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that every proper definition of this, of charash, of ra, it speaks directly of madaim, speaks directly of they want to be apostle.
Yeah. Wish I was more eloquent.
It's pretty. Kirk, we have Glenn, and I think he wants to make a comment on this. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. I don't know about that. It's casting aspersions. after, I wasn't going to say anything, but after about the seventh time, it's like casting aspersions, vilifying, okay. Backbiting, putting other people down, that sort of thing. It's interesting. I mean, this train of thought, I don't think you'll ever get consensus on it on a widespread, but it could be there, But,
I think there's only three people in all of human history that this could be written about. To some degree, it might include each of them. But if it were only one, I think it would have to be the one of the Apostle Paul. If you were to say, okay, there's only three people that did the kinds of things that God is adverse to here and is warning his children about, which means that this would have to be somebody that did things that was specifically harmful to them, that estranged them from God by using corrupt perversions and twisting. King Saul only did it in a very minor way. He took one of the statements in the Torah, added to it, augmented it, and then used his own variation to attack his own troops.
Mm-hmm.
Even as
Paul, the thing is, even if Paul were the most virtuous Eagle Scout, on the planet, the real issue is, someone's doctrine. So, if the best, basically this, from what I can see, amounts to basically a repudiation of things like salvation by grace through faith and replacement theology. You get rid of those two concepts and you're back with a Torah observant Yosha.
And of course, Paul to promote those concepts had to annul the Torah.
That is basically in a nutshell. It's basically replacement theology and salvation by grace and faith, poof, one take those away. And but even all of the Protestant Reformation. I mean, it's hardly anyone. I was always struck by the similarities, what I thought were similarities in attitude between Martin Luther and Paul. I always seen the meaning of Luther. Luther was a very Pauline guy.
Yeah, he was. Equally anti-Semitic. Anti-Torah, anti-Semitic. He hated Jews. Oof. Martin Luther's writings are even more overtly vicious towards Jews than were Hitler's and Paul's.
Right. So he was.
Bad dude.
What was Luther known for? The clarion call of Lutheranism was salvation by grace through faith. So if you take that away on the notion of replacement theology, you're well on your way to being back, being Torah observant as Yosha was. Because then you throw away Paul, turn your attention to Yosha, and you're back to where things were supposed to be.
It's so strikingly Paul, though, because with confusing and false perceptions which invert reality. I mean, that is exactly what Paul did. King Saul didn't do all that much as it relates to confusing and false perceptions which inverted reality. He didn't engage in irrational hallucinations and perverted myths which lead to annihilation. And that's from Habakkuk, which is to overturn and overthrow, inverting and upending, changing by reversing, converting through confusion with catastrophic results. I think there's only one person in all of human history that would apply to in from the perspective of Yahweh telling his children that the antidote for all of this is his Torah. That'd be Paul.
Right. Exactly. So, all right. Well, listen, I can't stay today. Okay. I better go. But it's funny without even knowing any of this other stuff, like about Paul or anything like that. Just if you come to, those doctrinal points, because that's what really makes Christians squirm. when you talk to them, because it's the core, you know, replacing right. theology and
right.
salvation by grace. You nail that,
right.
And the whole thing. The next thing, you know, you're left with. You take away Paul, and what do you have left? You basically have to go back to Yahusha.
Yeah, and the Torah.
And the Torah. Yeah.
You got nothing left. You got no religion left.
All right, Kirk, one of the things that strikes me here is that since this began with oaths towards and pledges towards one's country, mm-hmm. was there anyone who claimed a right for God that said that you should submit to your country?
Paul.
13th chapter of Romans, right?
It's going to be Paul.
Now, the first one.
The bad guys, he only cared about the ones that were attacking his family. So it narrows the field pretty quick.
Yeah, it does narrow the field pretty quick. And the guy that was most responsible for the animosity of Christians upon Jews is Paul. Now, his whole letters is filled with the Judaizers, or the really awful people. And he was always speaking of how Jews were trying to kill him and overturn him. And so the whole anti-Christian view towards Jews comes from Paul. But Paul was the one guy, the only one. I mean, everyone else says you should walk away and disassociate from your country. And Paul was the one that says, no, you should submit to your country.
Yeah, that's why you have flags and churches.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there's one of the homes in Ohio, the churches that I have to pass on the freeway, is right below one of these huge mosques right along the interstate. It's going to be a gargantuan mosque. And the Baptist church that's right below it flies a flag that's got to be 20 feet tall and 40 feet long. And it always has slogans that are unifying Americanism, patriotism, militarism, and Christianity. But anyway, it's Paul is the only one that would have done that. Now, to your statement, though, earlier on, the Torahless one, known as the Antichrist, the prototype for him is Paul, and he will do the same thing. He will say, you either pledge your allegiance to me, or you won't be able to buy or sell. You will be excluded. And so the only way to be included in the society and religion to be accepted will be to pledge your allegiance to him. Hadrian and the Romans were the same thing. You either pledge your allegiance to them, or they saw to it that you were tortured. Roman Catholic Church, for all of its existence, did this.
But who's Yahweh called out by name?
Only one person.
Yeah.
Shaul. Yeah, only one person. So when you put this together, we're in all likelihood dealing with, the one individual is Paul, and by implication, you can see King Shaul in this because of the fact that he's the prototype for Paul, and you can see the Antichrist in it because Paul is the prototype for him. So with confusing false perceptions which invert reality, this Hebrew word means irrational hallucination. Boy, there's nothing more to Paul than what he said was irrational. In fact, Paul even admitted, I'm insane.
Mm-hmm.
And perverted myths, the mythology of the charis, the gratia, the charities, and the Greek religion. Perverted myths, which lead to annihilation. What did he overthrow? What did he invert? What did he upend? What did he change by reversing? He created his New Testament to reverse the testimony of what he called the Old Testament. He inverted and upended the Torah. Through confusion, you had to convert to his religion. The tool was confusion, Babel, with catastrophic results. And he devised and inscribed antagonistic schemes without consideration for their consequence. He engraved, he wrote down, wicked plans, which conceal the truth, drawing lines in the sand whereby the ends justify the means, motivating many to remain silent for the sake of peace, meanwhile scheming to craft and implement clandestine and conspiratorial plots, which cause some to be deaf and others to be silenced and unresponsive. Well, this sounds a lot like political correctness to me, doesn't it to you?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Keep people quiet so you're dumbed down so that you just go along where it becomes way too risky, painful, costly to stand up and be heard. So very few people are willing to even tell.
Very hard to fight City Hall.
Yeah, and you won't even find people willing to listen to it because it's so contrary to political correctness.
I've experienced that, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want to talk about that. Go away.
Yeah, go away. Yeah. And he says that the consequences, which are evil and adversarial, objectionable and wrong, depraved and perverse, malignant and miserable. It doesn't sound like God here is tolerant and accepting, does it?
No.
In everything and continuously, creating controversies and continuous strife, stirring up heated, bitter, often violent conflicts through the application of human knowledge. Isn't that what Shimon Kefesh Peter wrote about Paul? That it's with human knowledge that he stirs up conflict?
Yeah.
That it was academic philosophy that he used to lead people astray with circular reasoning? That's exactly what he said about Paul's letters. To be in way, to be in discord, to engage in a quarrel. As one claims to be sent out as a messenger, as one claims to be an apostle. That's what Paul claimed. That's why Yosha in Revelation said, you know, thank God you did not accept that false apostle. And who was the rival to Yahuchanan, the author of Revelation? There's only one person that was a rival to him.
One person in
his posse, because he sent Timothy out to do his bidding. But no, it was Paul. I mean, he was it. That's why I'm so amazed that Christians don't see who the false apostle was in the open letter to the Ephesians. The one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important. Boy, that was Paul, claiming to be a messenger of God to do away with the Torah. Claims to have been dispatched, claims to be an apostle, reaching out to many while giving them free rein to dismiss something. Like how about the, put in parentheses, old covenant? Releasing them from something. How about the Torah? Sending them away with another message or messenger. Replacing Yahweh and Yosha and his word with Pauline doctrine. Sowing and impelling that which divorces.
Well, you know, I've covered this material for years and years and years and years, and it still just strikes me dumb.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm almost numb when I read it.
Yeah. It's just amazing.
Now, here's the part that brings us to a place where we can say, boy, he must be talking about the Torahless one known to Christians as the Antichrist. He says, upon this, therefore, suddenly, surprisingly, openly, albeit briefly, he will arrive with his destructive opposition and ruinous calamity. He will smash and shatter, breach and break something vital, and as a result, he will suffer affliction. It will happen in an instant, and there will be no remedy or cure. Now, the reason that most people might read this and say, well, that's speaking of the Torahless one known to Christians as the Antichrist, because he is going to be wounded and there will be no cure. But, you know, initially when he's wounded, he'll come back to life, and then he'll be taken down again. What's really interesting here is the stem. I have never seen a stem that did a better job of helping us translate. The verb is shabar. And what the stem here is, because what you see is that, you know, he in all the Babel translations, it says, you know, he will be wounded and there will be no cure. But wounded is something that happens to him passively. And yet that's not what the stem conveys. It's the Niphil stem. And this is what's really interesting. So we need to convey what the Niphil stem reveals. The Niphil stem reveals that this will actually occur because it's a counterpart to the call and should be interpreted literally. And that the subject, which is this deceitful individual, will not only carry out the action of the verb, which means he will smash and scatter and he will breach and he will break something, but that he will also endure the action of the verb. He will receive the action of the verb, which means as a result, he's going to suffer affliction. He's going to estrange and be estranged. He's going to induce suffering, and he will suffer.
Yeah.
He is going to be destroyed, but he will also destroy. He will grieve and cause grieving. He will break the Torah to pieces and thus be broken. He will maim and be maimed. He will alienate and estrange and be alienated and estranged. He will be bought, and he will sell out. He will interpret and parate, and he will be interpreted and will annoy. So the Niphil stem reveals that the action of the verb, smashing, scattering, breaching, breaking, have to both be perpetrated by this individual and be endured by him. You ever heard of a stem having that kind of influence over your translation? You can't pick one side. It has to be both ways.
Yeah, because usually it's action to something, or this verb is towards that object, or the noun or something.
So think of this. You know, Paul perpetrated this argument against the disciples, against Yahusha, against Yahweh, against his Torah, against his covenant. And he brought this argument, which broke these things, shattered them, breached them. And as a result of that, he was broken. He was shattered. He was grieved. What was his last letter, the third letter to Timothy, right?
All of them have lost. Everyone has left me, save you.
Everyone has left me. I've got nothing. I mean, it's just him wallowing in his own pity. I got nothing. Not anyone believes me anymore. Everyone has left me. Everyone has deserted me.
Shame they didn't burn all his letters.
Can you imagine how different
the world would be?
The book of Luke and Acts would have looked had Luke written it at this time rather than prior to this time. Because Luke was one of Paul's proteges, and then Luke, along with everybody else, came to realize the truth, but it was too late. He'd already published his propaganda piece in Acts on behalf of Paul.
Funny, he wouldn't have done a rewrite.
Well, probably did.
Probably.
What would the Christian church do with the rewrite?
They would have burned it. Yeah.
Well, of course. Absolutely. So here you have, by the way, there's the Barnabas, who was his pal, his first pal. That's the one he went up to Jerusalem with. And the first thing Barnabas does on the way out of Jerusalem with Paul is to say, "Hey, I'm out of here. I got nothing to do with you. You are the problem." You know, there is a what they call a gospel, but a book attributed to Barnabas that dates back to about the 4th century, mm-hmm. And in it. The principal claim of the book is that Paul is a false apostle and false prophet.
Really? I've never read it, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, that's the primary claim of the book, is that Paul is a false prophet and a false apostle, and that there was no bodily resurrection.
Wow. Very good.
Yeah,
whoever wrote it
knew the truth. But here you think of the Antichrist. He's going to be wounded and initially he is cured. There will be no long term cure. But in terms of the way this is written, this says that this is an individual who is going to scatter. Scatter from whom? Well, it's Yahweh speaking.
Mm-hmm.
That he's going to breach. Breach what? Well, there's only one agreement to breach. That would be the covenant. That he's going to break something. What did he break? Broke the Torah apart. And that as a result, he is going to be scattered.
that as a result, he is going to suffer and will be afflicted, be estranged. It's exactly what Paul did, and it's the fate of those who believe Paul. That's why it's written, you know, in broad base. Paul would have no reason to write a letter to Paul. Paul wouldn't be his child. He's writing to us about Paul,
mm-hmm.
to understand that this is the consequence of this man, that this man, in fact, is responsible. He's holding him accountable. And it's quid pro quo. What he did is being done to him. So if you follow along and you accept what he did, creating the religion of Christianity, then this is what's going to be done to you as a consequence.
After you wrote a question in Paul, how long was it before you realized that Paul is everywhere?
Yahweh
is just everywhere. He's telling you this about Paul.
Well, the first place was that I began to realize that at least on a dozen or more occasions that Yahusha had specifically targeted Shaul Paul and had brought him to our attention and told us how awful he was. And then, of course, I found the prophecies that Yahweh had made, but I had no idea there were this many. And we'll return to this tomorrow.